Welcome to Ex Chateau.
Ex Chateau.
The podcast that navigates the business of wine with unique perspectives and insights. With your hosts, Robert Vernick and Peter Young.
Welcome to this episode of Ex Chateau. Today we continue our exploration at wine importing, this time looking outside the U.S. at Singapore, a small island nation that probably disproportionately consumes more wine or has a bigger market than its population would suggest. So today we're here with Yishen Ong, the managing partner of KOT Selections. Yishen, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
Do you think you could give our listeners a brief overview of your background just to start us off?
Yeah, so I got interested in wine about a quarter century ago. It sounds like a long time ago.
Especially when you're only 30, right?
Yeah, I wish. So yeah, I started drinking before that, but it was mainly cocktails, beer. So I went up to the UK for my undergraduate. So I was really fortunate to be in a university where the colleges were well stocked with wine. And that's when I really got into wine. I joined the Student Wine Tasting Society and I had the chance to travel around Europe as well. So I worked in various wineries during my summer holidays, just out of interest. And that's where it really started, but that was never a career path for me, or so I thought. So I went to Stanford for my postgrad, and again, you know, I was in California, great access to wine. Very, very fortunate to fall in with a bunch of wine-loving enthusiasts. So some professionals, some amateurs, but that's where I got to know some of the importers and folks in the business as well. But then I went back to Singapore, and so I took what I jokingly called the most direct route to wine importing. So I worked in the government, in the Singapore government, and then management consulting, and then investment banking. A couple of life changes. Some friends passed away really suddenly when I was in investment banking. And sounds like a cliche, but it forced me to reevaluate my life and everything I've been doing up till then. So that was when, together with two partners, I decided, well, let's give this wine thing a shot. I had been basically buying wine for my personal consumption for the last 10 years, traveling to Europe. And we thought, okay, well, let's do this instead. We don't have access to these wines in Singapore. And we thought there was a market opportunity there. So we started the company in 2011 and we've been doing it ever since. So that's pretty much what the background is like, I guess.
And then could you give us a brief overview of what KOC Selections does or the scope of its portfolio and things like that?
Sure. So we started way, way back in 2011. The three partners, so KOT, simply put, is just the first letter, it's just an acronym of our surnames. So I wanted to call it Kwa, Ong, and Tan, but my partners thought, well, that sounds like an accounting firm or a law firm, so we've abbreviated it to KOT. And it's with my wife as well as a childhood friend whom I've known since we were 9, so We actually reconnected in California when I was doing my postgrad there. And we started buying wine together just over 20 years ago. And so we formalized, I guess, the arrangement. It was started partly out of frustration. So as I mentioned, we couldn't get access to the wines we liked to drink, that we were drinking anyway. I have to say it wasn't very well planned. We just decided, well, we wanted to drink those wines. We didn't see anyone else importing those wines. And we were young and naive back then. So that's how we started. We work with about 57 wineries. We call them wine growers because most of them are small, family-owned, artisanal, I mean, I hate that word artisanal, but artisanal boutique wine growers, primarily in Europe, but we've got 6 in the US as well. And that's what we do. So we import and we distribute locally in Singapore.
And so for those who aren't familiar with the structure of wine and alcohol regulation in Singapore, what's the structure of being a wine importer in Singapore? How's it different from the US or other markets?
Sure. So I think to set it in context, having lived in both the US and in the UK, so we're very different from the US. There's no legislation that, you know, forces one to be just an importer or distributor. So there's no three-tier system in Singapore. It's not monopolistic. So it's not like for example, the Canadian territories or Scandinavia. So I wouldn't say it's a completely free market, but it's pretty open. It's very different. I would say it's a bit more like the UK market. And by that, I mean, it's vertically integrated. So an importer can be both a distributor as well as a retailer. So you could sell into the trade and you could also sell direct to consumers. And so that's vertically integrated. So you see a lot of what I call, or what folks call, captive distributors and retailers, where they are actually owned by the importer. And there's also horizontal spread, I would say, because the barriers to entry are very, very low in Singapore. So just to give you an example, we set up the company and got going within 2 months for an outlay of what was back then about 200 Singapore dollars in terms of the licensing and on all the paperwork we needed to get done. So $200 is what, 120, 130 USD.
Wow.
And then we're up and running. And as you can imagine, we were not the only ones with this bright idea. So we probably, there are about 2,000, maybe 3,000 active importers in Singapore. There are plenty more licenses, but there are about close to 2,000 active importers, by which I mean, you know, they import at least once a year. And we're talking about a city of just under 6 million population-wise, not all of whom drink. So we were about 20% Muslim. I mean, Ramadan's just started here. So if you think about that, that's a lot of importers for a small, relatively small market.
And none of them were carrying your wines?
No, it's strange. I mean, I think we started at a really good time for two reasons. The market was still very, back then there were only about, well, I say only, about 700 importers. So, and a lot of them were focused on sources which were much closer to home. So for example, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. And they were very, very focused on either very big brands or high point scoring wines, which was what we are not in the market for. And I think the other factor was that the casinos, Singapore's got two casinos, we call them integrated resorts because they've got dining and entertainment integrated into the whole complex. And those two were just opening up around when we started. So that provided the spark for, I think, what you could say were alternative wines coming into the market. So I'll use the analogy of music. It was as if everyone was playing pop and nothing else. And then all of a sudden, college radio stations were available. So I think that was a niche that we were trying to plug into when we started the business.
College radio, huh? with 2,000 active importers, what do you think are the key elements of being successful in that space, besides, you know, differentiating yourself as college radio?
Right, yeah. No, I mean, you know, the college radio stations obviously have come and gone. No, I think it's not in any sort of order, but I think top of mind for me is having a clear identity, sort of knowing who you are and communicating who you are to your market, to your potential clients. So here, I think it's probably easier to reference some names which might be familiar to your listeners. So in the US, I took inspiration from Kermit Lynch and from Joe Dressner of Louis Dressner. And I was fortunate enough to get to know both of them when I was studying in the US. And then in the UK, which might be a bit less familiar to your listeners, but Yap Brothers, who were a Rhone specialist in the UK. So in different ways, I think all of these importers had very, very clear, very distinct identities. And they've been, I mean, Kermit's a legend in the industry, Joe in his own way, and the Yap Brothers as well. So they've established that niche. They've built it, I would say, in some cases, from almost nothing. And, you know, they've held on to it. So I think that's first and foremost the most important thing. So rather than importing the next $2 chuck or sub $10 Australian Shiraz, you know, without meaning to disparage those categories, I think that was really important for us.
Well, how would you describe the inspiration you got or the identity of Kermit Dresner and Yap Brothers?
Oh, let's go chronologically. So I first got to meet both Robin and his brother in the UK when I was a student, because I was interested and I had a thing for Hermitage. And believe it or not, Hermitage, Shaft Hermitage in particular, was actually accessible to a student on a student's budget back then. So I started purchasing from them when I was 19, I think. And they thought, this is funny, you know, here's this Asian chap who's clearly buying some of the best wines we have in our portfolio, and we'll like to speak to him because he's not buying a lot, but he seems to have interesting taste or an interesting palate. And, you know, he's only 19. So speaking to them, it was very, very obvious that they knew each of their wine growers intimately. They knew them really well. They had a very good sense of every single wine in their portfolio. And it was also very clear that this was what they wanted to drink, what they liked to drink. And therefore, they were really, really persuasive in selling those wines. I wouldn't say that was infectious, but it left a lasting impression on me, because the UK is very, very fortunate to have tons of great importers. But I mentioned the Yap Brothers because they were so clear about what they were doing and why they were doing it. And not to set up the contrast here, but I think for both Joe Dresner, who's passed on, and Kermit, were slightly different in that they were focused on the wines, obviously, and the wine growers. In speaking to them, they were, I would say, without being disparaging, but I think they were more like ideologues than the Yap Brothers. So they started with an idea of what they wanted to do. But again, that was also very clear and distinct and very different from what anyone else was doing in the market. I mean, I wasn't around back in the 70s and 80s, but Kermit started in the 70s and Joe in the 80s. But they were doing something, I think, quite radically different from most of the other importers. They were, in Kermit's case, visiting the wine growers. In Joe's case, similar. And these were wines that nobody else was importing, or hardly anyone else was interested in at that point in time. So not to digress too much, but I always think of Singapore as a market that is a generation or maybe even a generation and a half behind, say, the UK and the US. So if you think about it, we started in 2010, 2011. And so, yeah, we were exactly one generation behind when Joe and Kermit started.
So if I get you right there, you're kind of saying that they went and visited, uncovered, and found these small producers that are true artisans of their craft and brought their stories that weren't being shared, whereas other importers might have been focusing on much bigger producers that could ramp up scale for them. Is that the difference?
Well, that's partly it. But yeah, so I think that's a really good point. I mean, you asked me about what differentiates, you know, how do you stand out in the crowded Singapore market? And I think not to use a marketing term, but the storytelling, the narrative was so important. And I think that's what I think more so than the Yap brothers, that's what Joe and Kermit did very well in their own individual ways. So Joe Dressner, for those who might not be familiar with him, I think he was a bit of an internet celebrity before his time. So he's left, I think, he blazed quite a trail. He was very much a New York Jew, if I can put it that way. So in terms of his sense of humor, his approach to life, and everything else, really. So his identity was very distinct, very clear. And obviously Kermit with his book and everything else, and his newsletters, especially from the 70s, I think they were very clear in communicating, right, we're not, you know, doing what everyone else is doing. We can talk. So in Kermit's case, he would write lovingly about the brothers at Domaine Tompier in Bando, or he would write about Michel Brégion in Muscadet, and then Joe with Jean-Paul Brun in Beaujolais, or I would say probably also Domaine de la Papier in Muscadet. So there was that sense of care, there was that personality that went into what they did. And they communicated that very, very clearly, whether it's on the page, so in the days when print newsletters were still a thing, or now, you know, on their web pages. So the next generation's taken over at both importers, but I think both Anthony Lynch and Jules Dressner have very clear speaking and writing styles as well, which I think gives them that credibility and carries on the, I think gives them that distinctive edge, which maybe other importers might not have. And just to round off, I think that's less the case with the Yap brothers. Maybe it's British understatedness, but that's, you know, they take a softer, what I'll call a softer approach. But at least for me, no less persuasive in terms of, I think, communicating their love for what they were doing.
And so, you know, you build this portfolio of 57 wine growers from all around the world. How do you think about which wineries to partner with?
Yeah, I wish I had some master plan that I could disclose. To be honest, it wasn't very well thought out. So what we did was just to speak to the wineries that we were buying from in you know, in our private capacity. And I think a bit to our surprise, most of them, I would say about 90% of them were not represented in Singapore. That's crazy. So, I mean, and these are some of the biggest names in the business, if you're in the know. So it was mad, quite easy to add them to our portfolio. So we didn't think about it. We just thought about, well, you know, what are we drinking? What do we like? And it's funny when I say it now, but there was very little market research done. It was just, okay, you know, we drink these wines and so we'll import them. And if we can't sell those wines, we'll drink them. So that was basically, I mean, we've become a bit more professional in the 12, 13 years since. So we
sounds like a lot of winemaker stories.
Yeah. So we do think about, I think at this stage, plugging certain gaps in our portfolio. But one thing that has worked out for us, we've got this informal rule. So there are three partners in KOT, so, you know, the three of us. And our informal rule is that between the three of us, we need to have made 5 visits to the wine grower. So we, you know, I joke, I do go to the wine fairs and taste broadly, but that's not where we make our purchasing decisions. So we have this rule where between the three of us, we rack up 5 visits to the wine growers. And then and only then do we say, okay, well, we'll pull the trigger on this. It's worked well for us because I think if I had to use an analogy, it's a bit like the dating market where, you know, you don't go on one date and you, well, some people do, but you don't go on one date and say, oh, I'll jump into bed, I'll get married, have kids with this person. That's not the way it works typically. You know, having multiple visits across a certain time span helps us and also helps the wine grower to suss out who each other know, what we're like, how we can work or how we can't work together. And that's really been, I don't think we ever spoke about this consciously, but when we looked back, I think about when we were about 5 years into the business, and we said, you know, what's worked for us and what hasn't, I think that was the most evident thing, that the ones where we had taken our time to speak to the wine growers, to really understand what they were about, and conversely, them understanding what we did, what the Singapore market was like, those were the most successful relationships we had. So, you know, there wasn't any grand market research like, oh, there's a niche for Jura wines in Singapore and therefore we've got to go after someone that is Jura. No, it was really, can we get along with this guy? Do we like his kids? Because his kids are going to take over at some stage. Do we like the wines? And then we had faith, we had belief that if the wines were good enough, we'll find or we'll create the market for them in Singapore.
And so you mentioned, you know, maybe you find a market niche in Jura or something like that. How important do you think focus is on where you source from? There are some importers that have a specific niche and like area of focus, and others that, like yours, that are quite broad-based. How important is that focus, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is very important in terms of, I mean, I'm going to tie this back to what I said about identity and communication earlier on. I think that that's really important. So if you have a particular focus, again, to bring up US analogies for your listeners. So someone like Jose Pastor, you know, very clear Spanish focus, he knows what he's doing. He clearly is one of the guys who understood where Spanish wines as a whole were. I mean, and not to reduce a huge and very diverse country into just one category, but he obviously understood where Spanish wine was going, and I think he was ahead of the wave. So I think that's really important, because that ties into having a very distinct and marketable identity. Having said that, I do see, and obviously we've taken advantage of this, I do see an advantage in having a broad portfolio. So being able to serve a client and say, look, you know, right, you want a champagne, a Grolsch champagne, we've got that. You want a exact from Germany, we've also got that. You know, for your casual dining chain, you need a Prosecco. Well, bam, here you go. It's all high quality, very different wines, but we are able to fulfill most of your needs. So yeah, maybe that's not a very clear answer, but I think there are advantages in doing it either way. So either having a very clear focus in what you do, and we've seen successful examples of it here in Singapore as well, or having a more, I would say, supermarket approach, where you know you try and serve your clients as broadly as possible.
And so, you know, with your portfolio of 57 wine growers, what do you think is the optimal size for an importer's book?
Yeah, well, I guess I should say 57, right? It really depends on the size of the operation. So I would say about between 50 to 70 is about optimal. Because if you think about it, that's 1 week per wine grower in a year. And, you know, again, to bring up the date, well, you know, I'm not a believer in polygamy, but to bring up the dating analogy, you want to devote real time to each of your wine growers. And so if you end up with, let's say, 200, it's tough, you know, to communicate with them on a weekly basis. 200 is a lot. And I would say what one person can cover or what a partnership can cover is probably on the south side of 100, but I think it really depends or really varies from importer to importer. And then on the flip side, if you've only got 10 or 12 on the client side, it becomes a lot more difficult to fulfill client expectations and requirements. So yeah, I would say anywhere from probably 30 at least to make a good go at it, and then up to 100. But yeah, I think it varies very much from individual to individual.
Yeah, I like the calendar analogy to a week a year. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Why would wineries want to partner with KOT versus one of the other 2,000 importers?
Well, why wouldn't they? Once they've met us. I think, again, dating analogy, it was really a process of them getting to know us getting to know them. It's not as if we rocked up to every winery and they fell head over heels in love with us. I mean, we've pursued, or we've spoken to wineries who've decided to work with another importer for whatever reason. But I think what we offer them is a few things. Now that we've been in business long enough, we've got market knowledge, which a younger or newer importer might not have. We've got links to the trade, and we've got a client base that is not so easy to replicate. But I think, honestly, it's both parties finding their way with each other and being comfortable with that arrangement. So again, it's quite different, say, from the US. I think in our entire 13 years of operations, we've only ever signed one contract. It's always been a handshake deal, and you know, that's when we're comfortable enough. You know, I've gone for the kids' christening. We've seen divorces, remarriages. Basically, we've seen it all, and making sure that, you know, we're on the same page with the wineries. I think that's why they chose us, because they understand, or they're comfortable with what we're doing, and vice versa.
Does that mean the relationships you have with the wineries are not exclusive, or are they exclusive? Can they be exclusive with the handshake deal?
They are exclusive. It's all handshake. And don't get me wrong, we've been burnt before. So, and then it's funny. Well, it's not so funny when I think about it. But primarily when there's a generational change, and perhaps I don't get along with the son or the daughter as well. And they think, well, you know, we've been with this importer for a decade. And, you know, daddy did it his way, but we'll maybe sell a pallet to another importer and let's see how it goes. And we've just had a case of this actually in the last week, where the son has taken over the marketing, the commercial side of things. And yeah, it's not a pleasant conversation, but, you know, that's it happens. So yeah, it's basically exclusive relationships with all of our wine growers, because Singapore's not a huge market. It's a good market, but it's not a huge market. Very competitive. And unless you are a massive brand, it doesn't make sense for there to be more than one importer selling into the market.
Speaking of brands, how do you think about building the winery's brands in Singapore?
That's a really interesting question, because, you know, not to sound like it's amateur hour over here, but we didn't consciously think about it when we first started. So it was, and then naively, it was really, well, these wines are great. I mean, they're not just good, they're great wines. They are the apex of their respective regions. And so if we import them, if we get enough people to taste them, they speak for themselves. So, you know, that was a naive, unedited version of what we were doing. But now, oh yeah, it's a more conscious thing now, where we think, okay, you know, we talk about media, making sure that we put it in front of the right professionals. We think about consumer champions. So I don't like the word either, but influencers or key opinion leaders. And if we get the wines in front of them, chances are they'll like it because we know what their palates are like. Then we, yeah. So that's how, I think it's very much, for want of a better word, it's very much organic. So we try and build it one block, one step at a time. And, you know, it's not going to, it doesn't happen overnight. So, and sometimes it's just circumstance. So, for example, we represent Gonon in San Josef. And when we started, yeah, they were, you know, they were starting to become, I think, a bit sought after in the US and certainly in the UK. But to be honest, for the first three or four years, Gonon was not easy to sell because nobody wanted to buy San Josef. And all of a sudden, either they got a lot of points from some critic or there was this craze for it. And all of a sudden, well, it was allocated. Random folks were emailing us or calling us. Oh, you know, you have gone on. Can we buy some? You know, it didn't change what we did. So we still do our tasting of gone on every year. We have magnums for that purpose because, oh, I love magnums. So we host a lunch or dinner with back vintages of going on. And that's what we still do. I mean, even though the wines are highly allocated now, we want to make sure that, yeah, we get it in front of the right people and they get to taste it.
And in terms of critics and points you mentioned, how important is more local media versus international media in that sense? I know there's a few local writers in Singapore. James Suckling is based in Hong Kong, Jeannie Cho Lee. But other than that, like the major international ones are mostly US and UK based. How do those vary in terms of importance for the Singaporean market?
Well, I think firstly, there's the international influence is stronger here because Singapore English is the primary language of commerce and even everyday life. So, you know, the access to the English language media is there. So, and that's why the international media, at least for the wines we do, is more important. And I'm not dissing local media here, but it's because it's a small media market. So there are very few true wine specialists in the local media. Yeah, they're not that influential because their reach isn't that broad nor that deep. Whereas I would say he's retired now, but Robert Parker obviously had a big impact on the local wine market. I mean, to the extent where it was actually a Singaporean chap who bought him out. And I would say, yeah, the English language media, I mean, Jancis Robinson, I think there's some impact there. It doesn't look so different from the international English language media market in that sense. So only the top few really move the needle in terms of sales or brand recognition. And then local media, I think it's still useful because they help connect with, say, you know, a new restaurant or consumers who are just getting started.
So who would you put in that top few?
Without offending anyone. no, I would say for me, very clearly, Wine Advocate is still important, it's still influential. I mean, we on the commercial side of things, so for example, when we bid for a tender or when we try to get into a hotel wine list, yeah, the scores they ask for, obviously Wine Advocate. So that's a big deal. Jancis Robinson is an interesting one because I think people pay attention to her and her team, but there's a lot less emphasis on the scores. It's more, well, if she's written it up as a wine of the week or whatever, and then there's a surge of interest. But I think most tellingly, and then what's really changed in the last 15 years or so is the advent or the emergence of, consumer data. So whether it's Vivino or Wine Searcher or Seller Tracker even. So we've seen our And if we've watched this, we've seen this with our clients where something emerges on, or even Instagram. So something emerges on Instagram or Seller Tracker or what have you, and then that takes off all of a sudden. So it's not just, you know, I guess you could call them traditional media, but really sort of that grassroots, that consumer-led opinion. And then that's become increasingly important. So yeah, I would say Robert Parker or Wine Advocate and Jancis at the top. And then, to be honest, after that, not really anyone else. And then the consumer-driven sort of opinions, those are really, really important now as well.
That's interesting. So what have you seen as, given the, you know, some of the consumer-driven sites, your key opinion leaders, whatnot, but what have you seen as the most effective marketing strategies to build demand for your wines?
It really varies from wine to wine, from wine grower to wine grower. So for some of them, you know, I like the joke, to my everlasting shame, we have quite a few hundred pointers in our portfolio. So that obviously drives demand. You know, when one of the wines gets 100 points or perfect score, boom, right? That does matter. Not that we seek it, so we don't go down the list and say, oh, this chap got 100 points, let's go after them. So that's important in driving, I think, the short-term spike in demand. But what's more crucial is really, again, you know, getting the wines in front of the right people. So whether they are in the trade, so a sommelier or even a hotel buyer versus sort of, or I call them semi-pros, because they are clearly amateurs. They've got, you know, they've got day jobs, but they spend an inordinate amount of time reading about wine, drinking wine, discussing wine, and then communicating about wine. Do their friends, do anyone who would listen. And yeah, some of them, to be frank, are annoying, but many of them, what we call champion consumers. So they fall in love with a wine and they champion it all the way. And in many cases, more effectively than the professionals, because they're, you know, for whether it's true or not, they don't have that perceived conflict of interest. So there's no editorial slant going on. They sound far more authentic. They can be thicker, but when they bite down on something, when they chomp on something and they really love the wine, that's been, I would say, the most effective marketing channel for us.
So then how important are sales to the trade versus direct-to-consumer sales for KOT? And do you work with other local distributors to sell wine?
Yeah, so second question first. Yeah, we do work with other local distributors, not a whole lot. Because the market's so vertically integrated that the most distributors are owned by importers or vice versa. We are about 70-75% trade, so by which I mean selling into hotels, restaurants, even retailers, and then 25% private sales to end consumers. So again, you know, we don't have the same restrictions that importers in the US do. So we can sell direct to consumers, and we do it primarily via e-commerce. They're both important in different ways. So for example, when COVID-19 hit, and you know, our business mix was the same back then, we obviously lost the trade side of things overnight. You know, restaurants were closed, hotels were not open, no one was buying wine, no one on the trade side was buying wine. And so we were very fortunate that we had a private client base who were very loyal and basically saw us through the worst months of the pandemic. But at the same time, private clients or retail clients, there's only so much they can drink, right? Most of them anyway. And so you need to have that sort of consistent demand or consistent market from the trade. Just because, you know, you need to make sure that you keep moving wines out the door. Because if not, you start building up inventory and and then it's kaput after a few years.
Well, is that due to in large part because Singapore has a big tourism industry and trade will feed the tourism industry versus your private clients or just the locals who are drinking at home?
Yeah, that's partly it. Singapore's a really expensive place to live in now. So, you know, we've got Michelin-starred restaurants everywhere, but they're not cheap. Again, you know, how many folks can afford to go out and drop $500 on a meal every week? But yeah, the tourists sustain, I would say, the top to middle high end of the restaurant spectrum, and that's actually really important for some of our wines. So without the tourists, we basically wouldn't be able to sell those wines because the locals, and they buy a bottle a year, perhaps, you know, if we're lucky. But yeah, the tourist market is obviously quite important for us as well.
And so what have been the most successful tactics you've used to increase sales for your portfolio?
Yeah, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but again, it's about getting the wines in front of the right people. So give two concrete examples here. So when we started the casinos that just started, and Daniel Bulu, who's a New York-based restaurateur and chef, I mean, he's got multiple restaurants now. So when he opened up his branch, it was DB Bistro back then, in one of the casinos here, we loaded their list with over 100 references from our portfolio, which when you think about it, wow, that's a lot of wine. And that was because we tasted the sommelier team and they were, a couple of them were from the New York DB. And so they understood what we were doing. They got it. And then they loved the fact that, you know, instead of putting another, with all due respect, instead of putting another Kiwi Sauvignon Blanc in front of them, we've got a Sancerre, which was very mineral, very lean, which was a proper Sancerre. We had Muscadets, which were, you know, least aged, really interesting. We weren't selling them a Chateauneuf du Pape. We're trying to, you know, sell them a Gigonda or Vacquera or what have you. So, and then we had an extensive Beaujolais list as well. So that was what they were after. So that was really successful for us. And then on the consumer side, we've had some consumer champions who tasted the wines and said, wow, you know, no one else is bringing in Mondeurs from the Savoie. Or no one else has Old Vines Carignan from Priorat that is not 100% new oak and 15% alcohol. And then they go out there and they evangelize to their friends and they say, oh, look, you've got to try these wines. So, you know, it's not terribly, I guess, cutting edge, but it really is about making sure that people taste the wines, particularly for the sort of wines we import, you know, letting them speak for themselves.
So what do you see as the next big trends for wine importing in Singapore and maybe Asia more broadly, if you have a perspective there?
Ooh, I don't think I could speak for Asia. So I've been quite fortunate. I've lived in mainland China and also Hong Kong. So I don't think I can speak for Asia as a whole because it's such a large and diverse continent. And Singapore has its own distinct market characteristics. But I would say for Singapore, in no particular order, new regions, that's a big thing. So we've seen, we don't import any, but we've seen a lot of Japanese and increasingly Chinese wines coming into the market. I think that's a healthy thing. So, and I don't think we see that trend stopping or reversing anytime soon. So that's obviously growing awareness and demand for those wines. in this age of inflation or cost of living pressure, I think value. So obviously the 0.1% are going to buy their DRCs or what have you. But the bulk of the market, they're looking for value. So they want something that is, you know, bang for the buck, they consistently enjoy. And so I think in dollar terms, we're talking about wines that are between $5 and $10 ex works. So that translates into maybe $20 to $30 when it's landed in Singapore at retail price. And so we've seen that market, I wouldn't say grow, but it's become increasingly important rather than just the high-end wines. And I think on the flip side, I know there's been a lot of interest in low or no alcohol wines, but we don't see that in Singapore yet. I mean, I can't explain why, but that's just not a trend. And I think the other trend that has kind of passed Singapore by is rosé. So we import quite a number of rosés, but it's still as difficult to sell now as it was 12, 13 years ago.
Wow. Especially for such a hot climate, you would have thought that it would be a good fit.
Yeah, I know. I mean, when we speak to our wine growers in Tavel, which is a rosé-only region in France or elsewhere, I mean, that's something that is, to me, inexplicable, because I think if we could make a market for Savoir or Alpine Reds or heck, even Lambrusco, artisanal Lambrusco, you know, why hasn't rosé taken off? And, you know, beats me. I don't understand and I can't explain why.
Interesting. Well, we'd like to wrap up each episode on a personal note. What is the most coveted wine in your cellar and when do you plan on drinking it?
Ooh. Yeah, I think if it's coveted by the masses, probably one of the Bergs, you know, a DRC or something. But so just to go back to what I call the origin story, the first winery I worked for was in the Moser. And there I met a fellow intern, Daniel Vollenweider, who passed on a couple of years ago. And he started his winery, his eponymous winery in 2000. You know, I was a student, so I said, I'll come over and help out. You know, I can do the pruning, I can do the vineyard work and all that during my summer holidays. And because it was a young, new winery, he had no cash, so I got paid in wine. And then being young and foolish, then I said, well, you know, I want to be paid in beer and Auslese, which we made that first vintage. But I didn't want the small, dinky half bottle. So we struck an agreement where, you know, when we produce 50 liters of the beer and Auslese that year, if I remember correctly, and we bought it 2 magnums just for myself. So I still have those 2 magnums sitting at the winery, hand bottled, hand labored. I have no idea when I'll drink them, to be honest. Probably on my deathbed, because they're not ready yet. So I've dipped into
2 magnums on your deathbed. That's a lot.
Well, you know, low alcohol, sweet wine, you know, good way to go, I reckon.
Yeah. Well, Yixin, thank you so much for taking the time and educating our audience and our listeners on Singapore and what it's like importing wine into Singapore.
Great. Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. If you loved this episode of Ex Chateau, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, cheers.